All right, first matter on calendar this morning, Sir v. State. Counsel, are we ready to proceed?
Good morning, Justices. My name is William Waters. I'm with the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Giorgio Sir. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, very good.
And I would like to thank you, Justice Perrier. You actually did sign the order allowing me to participate remotely, so I appreciate that.
Yep, now I remember.
Okay. Mr. Sir was convicted after jury trial of very serious felonies and is now currently serving 8 to 51 years in prison. That was the result of a trial which was inherently unfair. And the trial was unfair because Mr. Sir had evidence to support a theory of defense, and he was precluded from offering that evidence systematically throughout the trial by the district court. The defense theory was first raised in his petition for writ of habeas corpus, where he discussed that this was an attempted citizen's arrest. The defense theory was again discussed prior
Mr.
to
Waters,
trial when
Mr. Waters, can you have an attempted citizen's arrest? I mean, does he have to be right about a felony? So was there, did he have evidence of a felony in fact?
Absolutely. And the evidence was not only his statement to McNeil, which was redacted, it was the videos themselves, which he could have authenticated through Charlotte when she testified. And there, well, because the crime we're talking about here is federal obscenity, which is a felony offense. It's punishable by 5 years in prison. I believe it's 18 U.S.C. 1465, I want to say. And that prohibits the interstate distribution of obscene materials, which would include videos that are posted on the internet, because the internet is a common carrier and it basically disseminates the information into every state in the country. So these videos, which I've admittedly graphically described in my brief, and also I did seek permission to send them to the court, which was granted. So the court does have these videos. These videos that Mr. Sir viewed absolutely meet the standard under Miller. Now, obscenity is an interesting offense in the sense that it does require a analysis or a finding that they violate community standards, and that can vary per jurisdiction. So it's not, for example, a bank robbery where if Mr. Sir had like video evidence of the person robbing the bank, it would be pretty easy to prove that a felony had in fact been committed. But in this case, fundamentally, the question of obscenity is it's not easy to necessarily prove. Mr. Sir can't say, you know, this they're guilty of obscenity. He can make an arrest based on what I'm arguing is essentially probable cause, that he had reasonable belief that the videos themselves were obscene, and he reasonably believed that the two individuals that he was attempting to arrest, Charlotte and Lucy.
But Mr. Waters, under the statute, though, doesn't it require, it doesn't really give a standard. It requires a felony to be committed and then a reasonable belief that the person committed a felony, right? Unless both of those things are known to some standard that's not contained in the statute.
Correct. And I would assert that that simply means that he has to have probable cause, because if you look at 171.124.1c, which I've mentioned in my brief, that deals with police officers making a warrantless arrest, and it uses the exact same language, a felony in fact committed and reasonable cause to believe the person committed it. And if you look at NRS 171.104, which talks about an arrest being made by both a police officer and a private person. So there's no statute that specifically limits the ability of private persons to make arrests, and there's no statute that enhances the requirement, I guess, evidentiary requirement to establish that a felony has been committed. I did send over supplemental authorities yesterday, and I apologize for the lateness in that, but in preparing for the oral argument, I came across a case from Maryland. Admittedly, that's not binding authority. However, it did a very good analysis, like a 10-page analysis on going back to like feudal England on the idea of citizen's arrest. And basically what Stevenson said was, look, it means probable cause. A felony in fact committed means probable cause. So those are specific facts.
Let me ask you another question, Mr. Waters. So if a person can make a citizen's arrest for something that is a federal crime, could a person go arrest anyone working in a marijuana dispensary?
Well, I mean, yes. Under federal law, which has not been changed, although I know there's been some discussions in Washington about declassifying marijuana, as of right now, federal law is supreme. And so, and this was a debate that occurred when Nevada was attempting to leave, or when Nevada did legalize marijuana. What is the impact on the fact that it's illegal federally? And I think that when that occurred, I believe that was during the Obama administration, his Justice Department just decided that they weren't going to federally prosecute people in the states who were engaged in marijuana commerce. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't. And it doesn't mean that any other president's Justice Department may change their views on that unless Congress takes action to either decriminalize it or deschedule it, I guess. And I understand that makes people uncomfortable, but these are legislative decisions. These are decisions for Congress. These are decisions for the state legislature. If the state legislature wants to limit the ability of a private person to make arrests and the manner in which they can do it, they certainly have had multiple opportunities since 1967 when this statute, 171-126, was first codified. But the fact that they haven't done it, you know, I mean, we shouldn't be making law here. The legislature has that responsibility. And quite frankly, you know, they can do this. They can say, you know what, this has to be, to effectuate a proper citizen's arrest, it has to be a state felony as defined in 193-120, I believe.
So on the topic of a proper citizen's arrest, you know, there's a knock and announce part of the statute that doesn't seem like it was really complied with here. So what's the consequence for that?
So I believe you're talking about 171-136 or 138. I'm sorry, 138, which is so that is breaking open a window or door to make an arrest. And it says to make an arrest of a private person, if the offense is a felony, and in all cases a peace officer may break open a door or window of the house structure, whatever. So here's the thing. If Mr. Sir, he was charged with attempt home invasion, but let's say he was charged with home invasion for breaking the door and he did not comply with 171-138 before doing so, he would not be able to argue, I have an affirmative defense to the home invasion. I believe that 171-138 is essentially inoculates you against criminal and or civil liability if you comply. So Mr. Sir, had he complied, knocked, announced, and then entered forcibly, and the state charged him with home invasion, I believe that he would be entitled to a jury instruction saying, look, as long as he complied with 130, if the jury finds you comply with 171-138, you know, he's effectuating a valid arrest, and he complied, he announced, he knocked, then, you know, he can be found not guilty. That statute, I believe, is essentially a statute that gives you a defense to both criminal and civil liability. It does not mean that you can't enter in any other way, because you can still be liable for the entry, the arrest could be valid, but there could also be an improper entry. So for example, Mr. Sir had gone to the house initially in October of 2021, and he was told to leave. He was arrested and he was taken to jail, and he was told don't come back. When he comes back in June of 2022, he's essentially committed a trespass because he entered after being told not to return. The state certainly could have charged Mr. Sir with trespass, convicted him of trespass, just for the entry. But the arrest itself and all the charges incident to the arrest, you know, he was allowed, that was his affirmative defense, and it provided a legal justification for what he did. Now, the problem is by stringing him along throughout trial, by giving him the you might get the jury instruction, by the time he testified, he had acknowledged all of the facts necessary for the state to prove its case. And then by saying, you know what, you didn't foundationally established the videos were obscene, even though I told you you can't discuss them when the videos themselves are the best evidence of, that they're obscene. Mr. Sir had no, what at that point, that was a fundamentally unfair trial. It was not an adversarial process. He was done. He had admitted all of the crimes charged. And his attorneys at that point said, recognize that he this is not a fair trial at this point. I have to ask for a mistrial, understanding that he would be retried because he requested the mistrial. And so the so even if you believe the district court judge was right, that he could not assert a viable citizen's arrest offense by waiting until the last minute to finally make that decision after Mr. Sir had testified, he had no opportunity to defend against these charges, and the mistrial had to be granted at that work at that point.
Mr. Waters, from a policy perspective, one of the things I am concerned about is that the statute seemed to give a private citizen greater ability to enter someone's home than a police officer would have, right? A police officer would have right. to have a warrant. Could you address that?
Correct. Well, so, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court's been very clear that the constitutional protections that or the constitutional protections that the police officers have to abide by do not apply to private persons. They said that in U.S. versus Jacobson. And that might make us uncomfortable. But here's the thing. If Giorgio's wrong, if he was allowed to present his defense and the court and the jury was allowed to consider it and they still convicted him anyway, then he goes to prison. So we expect police officers to comply with the Constitution, and there's remedies if they don't. Now, that remedy could be suppression of evidence, whatever. But civil liability very rarely attaches to police if they're operating in good faith, even if they violate your rights. Mr. Sir doesn't have those protections. So he's taking a chance that if he enters and he's wrong and the jury disagrees with him, he's going to prison and he's potentially and he's civilly liable as well, because Charlotte can always sue him because he invaded her property without justification. So I understand that we kind of think about this and it makes us a little uncomfortable, but this isn't a widespread problem either, because I do think that citizens understand that, look, if I'm wrong, I'm going to prison, and that constrains them from just randomly going into people's houses to make, like, you know, arrests. And again, the legislature can limit this if they want to. They have every ability to do that. They can say, like, you know what, you can't enter a house. And with respect to misdemeanors, public offenses, under 171.126, there's another statute that does talk about when the arrest can be made. And so there are other statutes that limit or constrain the nature of a citizen's arrest. And for public offenses, misdemeanors basically, it says it has to occur when it's committed in the presence of the private person, and the arrest has to occur immediately. With felonies, it's different. The felony can occur, and then later you can effectuate the arrest. So, but my point is, the legislature can do this, and if they wanted to, they can do this. Every state has citizens arrest laws still in the books. Nevada's not an outlier in that respect. Every state, and the District of Columbia, I believe, has citizens arrest laws. Now, other states might restrict your ability to do so in some way or the other, but again, those are decisions for the legislature. At this point, as we stand right now in 2025, and at the time of trial, 2022 or 2023, I'm sorry, Mr. Sir had a viable defense, a legal justification. At least let the jury consider that. And if the jury disagreed with him, then he goes to prison. But the problem here is they could never consider it after Mr. Sir promised them, justifiably relied on the fact that, you know, he was going to be able to present his defense. And it wasn't just Mr. Sir who believed that. The state first brought up the citizen's arrest defense in opening statement. They brought it up.
Mr. Waters, you should have most of your rebuttal time. Do you want to reserve the rest?
I know, I'm sorry. That's fine. I appreciate it. I appreciate the questions. I'll just save what I've got left. 146. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Elon Eldar, and I am here from the Clark County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the respondent of the state of Nevada. The appellant was not denied a defense to which he was entitled to under Nevada law. a defendant is entitled to a defense, a jury instruction regarding that defense when they, one, are able to present a valid, that the instruction validly states the law, and then two, that they have provided sufficient evidence under the law to every single element under that defense.
Well, I mean, how could he provide sufficient evidence when he wasn't allowed to present evidence?
Well, and that was discussed just a moment ago, but I think that the interpretation of what the district court said is incorrect. The district court, in its ruling, did not say that you weren't allowed to present any evidence because the videos themselves, he's not taking a position on the obscenity of the videos. What the district court stated was that you need to provide the other elements. You need to provide evidence of the other elements of the crime, which would be the distribution by Charlotte or by Lucy. And until he could establish that was one of the things. The other element that the court read into it was the exigency requirement that it found in the Minnesota cases.
Well, but didn't the court say it's a federal offense, so the statute doesn't apply?
No, the court did not say that. No. The district court specifically actually withheld ruling on the federal versus state requirement. If you look at, it is right after the defendant testifies, the district court lays out its reasons for why it was making that decision, and its decision was not based solely on the federal versus state distinction. It was based on the fact that he didn't provide exigency, which the court recognized.
All right, so how does exigency apply here at all? The Bill of Rights does not apply to a private citizen. Where does that come in?
Yeah, so the court read into the requirement based on the Minnesota cases of the case that the court cited and that the state cited in its brief, which was that in order to apply a citizen's arrest, that you would need some kind of inability to, well, let me clarify, a citizen's arrest that is trespassing into another individual's home, you would need some kind of inability to defer to law enforcement.
Where does it say that in our statute?
So in order to interpret that, it's not going to be directly in the statute. You would need to look at the statutes as a whole, which is that individuals are protected by laws in the state of Nevada from trespass, as well as home invasion and burglary. And that's what the court read it into in those Minnesota cases, which the court relied on here. Ultimately, though, the exigency is just one of the points. The court also made the ruling that the elements that were not provided was the distribution aspect of it. The appellant provided absolutely no evidence.
And Mr. Elder, was Mr. Sir prohibited from asking Charlotte and Lucy whether they in fact distributed the materials?
So initially when Charlotte testified, that is correct. They were prohibited. She was allowed to, well, the court said that they would keep her under subpoena to be able to testify again after the defendant testified. But the reason why she was prohibited was because the defense requires the appellant to be able to prove that he knew that they were distributing to it. If Charlotte were to go on the stand and testify, yes, I distributed whatever these potentially obscene materials were, that would not be relevant unless the defendant could say, I knew that she was distributing these materials, and I could actually prove that at the time of the arrest.
But doesn't the statute require, if it's in the context where he's not quite sure who did it, that a felony be committed, so someone is distributing obscene materials under 18 U.S.C. 1465, and he has a reasonable belief that is Charlotte and Lucy.
So that's under subsection 3.
Right.
So
okay.
The state's position would be that this is more of a situation of subsection 2 where the felonies are not being committed in his presence.
Okay, but if he has if the videos themselves, just if we're just going down that rabbit hole, if the videos themselves are obscene material that has been distributed and it's in interstates on the web, but he doesn't know who did it. That's subsection 3, if he has a reasonable belief that Charlotte and Lucy are the ones that distributed it, correct?
If it's committed in his presence.
No,
subsection 2, the distinction between subsection 2 and 3 is whether the crime itself is committed in his presence.
No, that's the difference between 1 and 2, right? Yeah. For a misdemeanor, it has to be in the presence. It doesn't say anything about that in 2 or 3.
So subsection 2 reads, when the person arrested has committed a felony, although not in the person's presence.
Okay, number 3, when a felony has been in fact committed and the private person has reasonable cause for believing the person arrested to have committed it. So why doesn't that one apply?
So how courts have interpreted those different statutes that the state has cited in its brief is that subsection 2, and these are the California courts in Aldapa, and Ward will apply when the so subsection 2 applies if the felony is not committed in their presence, and subsection 3 will apply when it is committed in their preference in their presence, and when it is committed in their presence, they will give some leniency towards the arrest of the individual as to the specific identity of the individual. That's how those sections have been interpreted by other courts,
If the felony was committed in the person's presence, then they would know who committed the felony. Like, how would that ever apply?
Well, that's why they give them more leniency to it. If there was some sort of mistake on a cell, for example, imagine you were to come across two individuals that are fighting in public. Somebody gets injured. You don't have an exact, you know that some felony has been committed, some battery, substantial bodily harm has been committed, but we don't know exactly who started the fight. That gives you that authority to go in there, break up the fight, and detain the individual, even though, because you had some reasonable suspicion. It makes more sense, though, that when a felony is not committed in your presence, that you better be incredibly certain that the person who you are arresting or trying to arrest actually committed that felony. That's why that distinction is there between those two statutes. Otherwise, the language is superfluous.
Well, but number 3 doesn't have the language you're reading in there.
Correct.
The felony has been in fact committed. So if he turns on the internet and sees these videos, is he looking at a committed felony? Did he show evidence that what was up on the internet was a felony?
So the videos themselves are obscenity. He provided the videos to the court. Ultimately, the state, the difficulty in the obscenity itself is going to be what the appellant mentioned, which is that it relies on these community standards, which is the inherent difficulty for arresting people on this kind of crime by itself. But even if you were to assume that this was obscenity,
okay,
you still have the problem of connecting Charlotte to the person that is distributing these this video. The only evidence that was presented that Charlotte distributed the video was that there was a Twitter account bearing her name.
Okay, why isn't that evidence, and why couldn't he ask Charlotte, hey, did you post these videos?
Because it's only going to become relevant if he can prove that it was
But he has a burden of production, and why can't he produce that evidence through that witness who's on the stand?
Because he'd be producing it after the arrest took place. In the same way that an officer...
He's a reasonable belief. So he's saying, I believe Charlotte and Lucy are making these videos. I've seen the videos. They're in them. They're posting it from their account or somebody with their... that I presume is their account. If we're again down this rabbit hole, why isn't that a reasonable belief on his behalf that Charlotte and Lucy are the posters?
So if he had so the question was about asking her on the stand.
Yeah.
If he had asked her prior to arresting her, then that would be sufficient.
Why can't he ask her on the stand?
Because it doesn't go to what his mental state was when he was committing the arrest. He could not know what she was going to testify on the stand when he's committing the arrest.
At the time he was committing the offense, why was it unreasonable for him to believe that somebody whose Twitter account is owned by Charlotte posted a video on their own Twitter account? Why is that unreasonable? Because he only has to show he's reasonable.
So there is no evidence. So the problem with the Twitter account is that anybody can go and make a Twitter account, and that wouldn't be probable. If an officer were to present that in their affidavit before the court to get an arrest warrant, that warrant would be denied. If the only evidence that an officer had was, I saw an account on the internet post a video, so that would get denied.
He, under the statute, only needs a reasonable belief, right? That is not probable cause. It's a different standard, and it's lower.
Well, he needs a reasonable cause, which has been interpreted to be probable cause by other courts. For that third subsection, that's going to be in the California case, Aldapa and Ward. I still believe we're in the second subsection because it's not committed in his presence. But even under subsection 3,
Your position is a reasonable belief is the same thing as probable cause?
My position is that reasonable cause is interpreted as probable cause. And the position for that is
also... The statute says reasonable belief, right?
The statute says reasonable cause. The statute says reasonable cause, and this additional support for that claim that means probable cause is that when you look at NRS 171.124, subsection 1D...
If the legislature meant probable cause, why didn't they just say that?
I couldn't tell you that, but this court has interpreted reasonable cause to mean probable cause. This court has interpreted in a couple of cases that under NRS 171.124, the statute, and specifically subsection 1D, The language there is on a charge made upon reasonable cause of the commission of a felony or gross misdemeanor by the person arrested. That specific language is the language which affords peace officers in the state of Nevada to conduct arrests for probable cause. So California courts have interpreted reasonable cause to mean probable cause. This court has interpreted reasonable cause to mean probable cause. So beyond that, I think that we're in the world that reasonable cause means probable cause, which if you were to, if you were to, as I was saying a moment ago, present this to a court, they would deny this because they would deny that affidavit for arrest because there was no actual evidence linking the owner of that account to Charlotte.
It's just the posting itself of pornography. Would if it's just pornography and the posting on the internet, would that be a felony?
Under federal law, not unless it was considered to be obscenity.
Okay, so in this instance, the crime that he's alleging was committed was going to be within the community standard. Because pornography in and of itself is not obscenity.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And just to touch on a moment ago,
in the context of establishing a defense, how does that get established? How should he have done this at trial?
How should he have done it at trial?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to assume he would need to provide some amount of evidence that set aside the state versus felony distinction. If the court believes that there's a state versus felony distinction, that the Nevada legislature intended only to
reference. Let's assume there's not, because the statute just says felony, but how would he properly present this at trial?
What he would need to do is provide evidence that at the time of his arrest, some amount of evidence that he knew, and that's why the whole getting Charlotte to testify at trial doesn't work about it, he needs to provide that he knew that these people were committing a felony, and the state would also say that there would be some kind of exigent circumstances that go into an individual's home, because otherwise, what you're reading to the fact is that he has greater powers than police.
That's what the statute seems to say. He can just bust in windows, kick in doors.
Well, that statute puts them on the same grounds as police in terms of, but it doesn't state the manner in which you can do it. The manners in which it would be allowed to go into the home under those exigent circumstances. It just says how you would do it, if you were allowed to do it.
I don't understand why we would apply the Fourth Amendment, any Fourth Amendment jurisprudence here when it's a private citizen.
Well, I'm not asking the court, and the respondent's not asking the court to apply Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, but what it does is just it acknowledges the public policy reasons for why you would want to have this difference and what the Nevada legislature could have been thinking. Because when you look at the statutory scheme, you do notice those differences that the Nevada legislature has set arrest by private persons to a different standard than peace officers.
But it's not really our job to make up things in a statute when the statute's pretty clear, right?
Well, the respondent would posit that the statute is not pretty clear in terms of how you would go among doing this arrest, what the standards are for this arrest, and that's why we need to look at those surrounding statutory scheme. In the same way that when you look at the peace officer distinction, the distinction between FBI agents, Secret Service, throughout those multiple statutes, every single one of those statutes gives a lesser burden for officers to arrest. And the Nevada legislature even included that lesser burden under the shopkeeper's privilege statute, where they chose to say that shopkeepers have the right and ability to detain people for probable cause, and then specifically left that provision out of this statute. So what is going on is the Nevada legislature is creating an environment where under NRS 171.126, they have less rights than peace officers to arrest.
This may be outside. It's not outside. But Mr. Elder, what would have been the harm in giving the instruction? Because here we are having these facts are batty, okay? And now we're having a discussion here because an instruction was not given and evidence was not allowed in. What would have been the harm? I'm putting you back. You're now the trial. You're the trial. You're the state at trial, and they've offered this instruction. What would have been the harm to the state in giving the instruction?
The harm to the state is that these instructions are confusing and may confuse a jury to the ultimate result.
To believe what? May confuse a jury that he's not guilty?
Well,
that he's guilty.
The harm also that they don't validly state the law. So the state doesn't believe that you should be presenting instructions to a jury that don't state the law correctly.
Well,
but a citizen's arrest, I'm sorry, may I go ahead?
Yes.
Okay. A citizen's arrest would be a valid defense, right?
Yes. But it validly stated. If the instruction that they were requesting was correct, which was not.
So your issue here is not necessarily instruction, but the instruction that they gave was incorrect.
That is one of the issues. So the instruction that they gave was, the state agrees with portions of the instruction. So the part of the instruction included mirror the necessity defense, which the state believed that is the correct way to approach a citizen's arrest defense in terms of the preponderance of the evidence standard. That was the instruction they gave. The state agrees with that portion of it. But the state does not agree with the portions of it that say that you can make an arrest for federal law. And the state also doesn't agree with the portion, or the state, to take a step back, also doesn't agree that they even provided enough evidence to get the instruction in the first place.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you. I just want to address, pick up on the idea about 171-126 sub 3. And it does state, as Your Honors clearly indicated, the reasonable belief portion of that goes to the identity of the person. So Justice Stiglitz is 100% correct. That's what that means. So Mr. Sir just had to have a reasonable belief that the two individuals that he was attempting to arrest were the ones responsible for the distribution of these obscene materials into interstate commerce. And the evidence that he had was, it was a Twitter account bearing her name and likeness. It was at a time when Twitter actually gave you a blue check mark to indicate that this is the actual person and not like a bot or something like that. He had researched their production company, which was Fluffy Cat. These two individuals were married. They released videos under that production company. So look, whether that's all true or whether she sat at a desk and posted the video herself is completely immaterial under sub 3. All he has to do is have a reasonable belief that she did it. And I believe in it.
But Mr. Waters, doesn't that presume, yeah, he still has to show by some standard that a felony was committed? And
right,
even under his facts, a felony may have been committed. Correct?
Well, but then respectfully, Justice Stiglitz, then the citizen's arrest law is completely, you could never rely on it. I mean, how do you prove a felony has been in fact committed if it's not merely probable cause? I mean, police officers arrest on probable cause and eventually.
Well, because here it turns on whether the pornography is obscenity. Because if it's pornography and it's not obscene, then it's not a felony, period. If somebody shoots somebody in the head, then yeah, a felony's probably been committed. It's not.
Well, and that goes to the uniqueness of the charge. But I would posit that these videos were far outside normal, healthy, mainstream pornography. And he met the standard he needed to show that. I could find 12 people in Las Vegas right now who would deem those videos obscene. And I think Mr. Sir could have convinced his jury.
You think you could find 12 going the other direction?
Maybe. But that's the uniqueness of obscenity. It's a unique crime. You're right. I mean, you're absolutely right to point out. Like, it's the level of proof he would need would have to go to the jurors themselves, and they weren't allowed to even consider that. They might have said, had they been properly instructed, you know what, we don't believe these videos are obscene, so your defense is invalid, and now you're guilty. However, those jurors could have said, look, you know, those videos were obscene, and so he was completely justified in doing it. I apologize for going over.
Mr. Waters, I have one more question. To Mr. Elder's contention that the proffered instruction was not a correct statement of the law, can you briefly address that?
Yeah, I respectfully to Mr. Eldar, I don't understand what he's talking about. The instruction was basically 171-126 sub 2 and 3. There was an instruction that defined obscenity under both the Miller standard and the standard that we've codified, which is essentially the Miller standard. So I don't know what instruction he's talking about. Those were the instructions that were proffered. And basically we said, like, look, if you believe this was a valid citizen's arrest, he's not guilty of the charged crimes. That's just garden variety theory of defense instruction.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Waters.
Thank you.